Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really happy today to be talking with Richard Heinberg. And Richard and I have spoken before about peak oil. His first book, I don't know if it was your first book, but...
It was actually my fifth book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the last one was The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies. And the new book is called Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World.
And it's a great book, like was The Party's Over. And one of the great things about it is it's so short. I hate to be so superficial, but it's really important to me, and I'm sure to a lot of people because we're all so busy.
Mm-hmm. Well, The Party's Over was not a terribly long book. It's about a 300-page book, but it's a good overview of the whole oil industry and oil dependence and energy issues in general, but especially peak oil. It's a real primer on peak oil. The new book, Power Down, is shorter. It's of course, updated. It has the latest information on peak oil, but it's also much more about policies and actions.
Well, and we're going to have enough time to talk here so that we're going to focus on this first interview because we're also going to do another one. We're going to focus on the issues, the problems, because peak oil, people might not even know what that means right off the bat because people are so, tend to be many people. Mm-hmm. I don't want to insult any listener here, but you know, so many people are really uninformed about what's happening. In my experience, just about everybody I talk to, and I live here in Berkeley where people are more educated than many places because we have independent media here. So, Richard, we're going to focus on this interview, as I said, about what the issues are, the challenges, the problems that we need to take action about and change our lives. So what is peak oil?
It's when supply is no longer able to meet demand. Now, peak of oil production is something that's happened many times before in history. This is not just a prediction of something that's never happened before, and it may or may not happen. The U.S. experienced an oil production peak in 1970. Prior to that time, the U.S. was the world's foremost oil-producing country. In fact, we were even the world's foremost oil-exporting country for many decades. But after U.S. oil production achieved its all-time peak in 1970-71, it started going downhill, and it's been going downhill virtually ever since. Nobody really anticipated this except for one petroleum geologist by the name of M. King Hubbert. But after it happened, more and more people started getting interested in this phenomenon. It turns out that extracting oil from any given well or province or country follows a kind of bell-shaped curve. We get the cheap, easy stuff out first. And then when about half the oil is gone, the rate of oil extraction tends to start to decline. And then what's left is the more difficult to access, lower quality crude that takes more energy to get out of the ground. And that's essentially what's responsible for the peaking phenomenon.
So I often say oil is running out, and you, or somebody once corrected me about that. And so when other people say oil is running out, I say, well, not exactly, but for all intents and purposes, in terms of how it's going to affect us, it's kind of like oil is running out.
Right. Well, yeah, oil has been running out ever since we took the first barrel out of the ground. But when we talk about peak oil, we're not saying that, in fact, you know, the last barrel is going to be pulled out of the ground anytime soon. Far from it. We're only at about the halfway point, so that we've extracted about 950 billion barrels of oil so far in the last 150 years. And there's about a trillion barrels of oil left to extract. The problem is the rate of extraction is about to peak and decline. And the significance of that is that we have depended upon increasing amounts of cheap oil to provide cheap energy for an expanding, ever-growing industrial society with growing economies. Now, once we no longer have that cheap, easy fuel for our economies, especially for transportation, it's going to be very difficult to maintain economic growth. The whole idea of economic growth is something that has appeared just in the last 200-300 years during this amazing, very unusual period of human history where we've every year had more resources and especially more energy available. But that's going to change. And when it changes, it's going to be as dramatic a transition as we experienced in going from the medieval society to an industrial society. Basically, industrialism as a way of life is about to come to an end.
Well, I just want to say in terms of what you're talking about, cheap oil, that people get confused, even those who sort of try to look into it, they get very confused by the figures and they say, oh, there's lots of oil still and it's going to be forever. So, folks, I just want you to notice that that's the deal. I mean, there may be lots of oil there, but the point is it's too expensive to get, so it's kind of irrelevant.
Right. People ask sometimes about the Canadian tar sands, for example. There's a vast amount of hydrocarbon stuff there under the Alberta soil, literally hundreds of billions of barrels equivalent of hydrocarbon atoms. But they're in a form that's expensive and difficult and environmentally ruinous to get out of the ground. So at what rate can we get the Canadian tar sands out? Well, currently it's about 1 million barrels a day, which is nothing to sneeze at. That's good for Canada. It's one of Canada's main energy sources. But we're using 82 million barrels a day of oil worldwide right now. And the best estimates are that Canadian tar sands production can probably only be ramped up to about 2 million barrels a day for purely physical geological reasons. It takes too much fresh water and natural gas to produce oil from the Canadian tar sands, and those are limited resources. So it's like that with one story after another. Once you really begin to look into the oil industry, you realize that there are serious constraints. We have not been finding that much oil lately. As a matter of fact, global oil discovery peaked in the early 1960s, and it's been going downhill ever since. Of course, you have to find the stuff before you can extract it. And at this point, we're finding only about one new barrel of oil every year for about every 5 or 6 that we extract and burn. So you can't keep doing that forever before you do, in fact, start running out.
Wow, I think I'm going to repeat that. One new barrel of oil a year for every 5 or 6 we're extracting. Got that.
Right.
So I want to say, too, that I know something about Alaska and how the environment is so ruined for the people who live there. And then the amount of oil it's gotten is for like about a week.
Right. Well, one sign of how low the global gas tank is running is the fact that we are having to turn to such dangerous and difficult places increasingly to get our oil. In the early decades of this century, we were getting oil from nice, convenient places like Texas and Oklahoma and Southern California, Pennsylvania even. And now we're getting it from offshore derricks that drill deep into the rock strata underneath the oceans. That's a very expensive way to get oil out of the ground. We're also getting more and more oil from politically sensitive places, the Caspian Sea region, places like Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan. And increasingly, places that have the remaining oil are becoming politically destabilized. I'm thinking now of countries in West Africa, Sudan, Colombia, where people are fighting over control of their own nation's resources. So the first half of the curve, the cheap, easy oil, is now a thing of the past. And what's left is going to be oil that will not only be expensive, but it's oil that I'm afraid is going to be fought over increasingly.
Well, we're already seeing that. It seems pretty clear that Iraq and Afghanistan and right now, and things to possibly, hopefully not, but possibly to come in the wars that the United States is proclaiming, unless we stop this madness, have to do with oil?
Well, our current Vice President, Dick Cheney, is, of course, the former CEO of Halliburton, the world's foremost oil services company. And he gave a speech in London in 1999 to the Petroleum Institute while he was still CEO of Halliburton. Cheney said at that time that global oil demand was growing at a rate of about 2 to 3% a year. Meanwhile, depletion from existing resources is taking a bite of about 6 million barrels a day. So we have 2 million barrels a day needed for new demand, then about 6 to 7 million barrels a day every year is needed just to replace depletion of current production capacity. So add those together, we need about a new 8 million barrels a day every year just to stay even. He said by 2010, we will have to replace about 6 out of 10 barrels a day of production current with new production from new discoveries. But he said also that's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to achieve. So he was essentially, when he was speaking to the petroleum industry when he said this, but he was essentially saying we are in an impossible situation, because by 2010, we will need much more oil than will actually be available. Now, only a couple of years later, Cheney turns up as Vice President of the United States. The very first thing he does is convene his secret energy task force. We don't know what they talked about, but a few papers have been released through Freedom of Information Act requests. And those papers are essentially maps of the oil-producing regions of Iraq. So there are a number of documents, these included, which clearly suggest that Cheney, who is effectively the energy policy point man for the current administration, also foreign policy, energy policy and foreign policy, that when he took office, he already understood the profound necessity for the U.S. to secure more energy supplies in the future. And he also understood that Iraq has the world's second foremost reserves, and what's more important, the reserves of Iraq have hardly been touched for the last 20 years. Other countries with major oil reserves have been largely depleted. Even Saudi Arabia, which has the world's foremost reserves, in fact is not in nearly such good shape because the great Ghawar field, which produces about 60% of Saudi production, is itself about to peak. And this is known from a number of studies which have shown that Ghawar is currently being it's currently in secondary production. They're using injection of about 6 million barrels a day of salt water in order to maintain pressure in the field. And no one knows how long this can be continued. At some point, probably in the fairly near future, Ghawar, which is the world's largest oil field in Saudi Arabia, is going to begin its decline, and it'll be a fairly rapid decline because of the extraordinary measures they've been using to maintain pressure in that field. When that happens, Saudi Arabia is no longer going to be able to be the swing producer, and Iraq will, by default, be the most important oil-producing country on the planet. So what have we done? We've established 7 new permanent military bases in that country, and we have no intention of leaving. This is part of a long-term strategy. This was not just a whim on the part of George W. Bush to invade Iraq. This is a long-term strategy that is, at its core, I hate to say it, a bipartisan strategy. It's not just the Republicans.
Yeah, well, we could go off on so many tangents here. I mean, they're not really tangents, but we don't have time to do it. Like Halliburton making all this money and all this overcharging and all this, like, really scandalous stuff going on in Iraq. And 9/11 itself.
Right.
Who and why 9/11 happened and who perpetrated it. But we won't go into that right now. Unless you want to say something, but Richard Heinberg.
Yeah, we have to understand that this is a watershed event that is approaching. When global oil production peaks, the whole world will change. All of the economic ground beneath us is going to shift, and this is entirely predictable. People like Dick Cheney clearly understand that this is coming our way, and the U.S. economy is teetering on a knife edge right now, partly because of the tremendous rate of U.S. debt. But this has been run up, or a great proportion of it has been run up just in the last 4 years during this administration. And I think this is also a part of the same strategy, effectively to bankrupt the U.S. and to create the conditions for effectively a new world war. Because once the world is past global oil production peak, the gloves are going to come off, and swords are being sharpened even as we speak. There is increasing geopolitical competition between U.S., Russia, and China, and Europe over the world's remaining oil supplies. China and the U.S., which are locked in a kind of deadly embrace with U.S. importing so many manufactured goods from China, China then taking the income from those sales and reinvesting them in the U.S. economy, enabling the U.S. to run up trade deficits and also huge government deficits. But then the U.S. and China competing for the same oil supplies globally, oil from the Middle East, from Central Asia, from West Africa, and even from places like Venezuela. China and U.S. companies are going after exactly the same resources. And that competition is severe now, but I think it's going to become deadly in the fairly near future.
You know, it must be that one of the biggest users of oil is war.
Well, yes, that's the terrible irony. One would think that this would be the most insane way of dealing with the problem of oil production peak that one could possibly think of, to simply fight for what's left and use up much of that precious resource in the process. But, you know, I think U.S. leaders have painted themselves into a corner. We had the option in the 1970s to deal with our increasing addiction to imported oil through efficiency and through the funding of research into renewable alternatives. We started down that path, but we didn't get very far. In 1980, of course, it was mourning in America. We had a regime change in the country and the Carter administration, which I don't want to suggest the Carter administration was doing all the right things, because they weren't by any means. That was, after all, the time of the institution of the Carter Doctrine, which said that henceforth we will use the U.S. military to defend our access to the oil supplies of the Middle East. But nevertheless, Carter did go on television and tell the American people that energy resources are ultimately limited, and that we have a choice to make, either to become more dependent on them or to change our way of life and find a way to live with less oil. And, well, we didn't do the latter. We chose during the 1980s and 1990s to become more dependent. Our oil consumption increased. And now we're living with the fact that almost 60% of the oil that we use in this country is imported from elsewhere. And that dependency is a profound vulnerability.
And I want to tell people, you know, when we're talking about oil, we're not just talking about cars. We're talking about plastic. I mean, just about everything. Fertilizer. Just about everything's got some oil in it these days. Clothes.
Right. Agriculture is one of the most crucial uses of oil, and natural gas also, because, of course, we use natural gas for the production of fertilizer. But most of the agricultural chemicals are made from oil. And then the operation of all of the farm machinery, and then the transportation of food, the typical food item on our plates these days, has traveled 1,300 to 1,500 miles to get there. And, of course, those are fossil fuel miles. And it's not just our transportation to go to the store or to get to and from work, but also, you know, how does all of this stuff get to the stores for us to buy? We are living in a system that demands long-distance, speedy, large-scope transportation of just about everything in order to maintain our way of life and our economy.
I'm taking a long time here to remind the listeners who may have just tuned in, let them know that my guest is Richard Heinberg, whose most recent book is Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. And right now we're kind of defining the problem because so many people don't really even understand about that. We are going to get into some solutions here, and you can also turn into the next show where we'll be even more deep into that. And I didn't mention that Richard Heinberg teaches at New College of California in Santa Rosa and teaches human ecology. And I'm thinking just about the connectedness of everything. I'm wondering, too, pulling all that oil out of the earth must have a lot of repercussions to the earth itself. And I don't know, but of course that's not exactly human ecology, but I just think, you know, you step on something, there's nothing there, boing, you go through. Right. And a good effect could be no more global warming.
Well, I wish I could say that the problem of global oil peak does have, you know, a kind of silver lining, but I have to tell you, I'm not seeing it at this point because you mentioned global warming. Yes, global warming is a huge, huge problem, probably larger than most of us realize, but we are only about halfway through our extraction of the oil that is ultimately going to be pulled out of the ground and burned by human beings. Yes, the rate of extraction is about to peak and decline, but there's still a trillion barrels of oil there in the ground that we are likely to pull out and burn over the course of the next century, and that's a heck of a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Also, there's a strong likelihood that as oil and natural gas become more expensive and scarce, we will turn to coal to make up the difference. And, of course, coal is even dirtier and will produce even worse emissions than oil and natural gas. So, again, I wish I could say there's good news here, but I don't see that.
Yeah. And I'm sure as oil gets more expensive, the rich will get it, the poor will not, but the poor will get sick from the air pollution.
Well, currently we're supporting a global population of over 6 billion people, 6.4 billion. At the time the Industrial Revolution started, there were fewer than 1 billion of us. That immense increase in human population is largely attributable to fossil fuels because we're able to transport resources from where they're abundant to where they're scarce and build cities where otherwise large numbers of people could not live. I'm thinking now of the Arizona desert or a place like Southern California where we put millions of people and the only reason they're able to live there is because we can truck in or ship in or pipe in vast quantities of water and food and everything else that people need in order to survive. So when we talk about peak oil, we are talking about literally human survival. We are going to have to find a profoundly different way of living on this planet than we have gotten used to over the course of the last century. And that's every single one of us. We have all grown up in the context of the assumption that there's going to be ever more of this stuff in order to maintain economic growth and keep us in the way of life to which we've become accustomed. And that assumption is about to come crashing down.
Oh, we just saw, well, you're in it. I just have seen the film called The End of Suburbia, which is a real nice way to educate people. We're watching a film for an hour and 15 minutes to educate people about this. Do you know the website or how to get The End of Suburbia, Richard?
Well, yeah, people can get the DVD from postcarbon.org. And also they can buy my books through that website and lots of other relevant material to the subject of peak oil. I think that's an excellent film for people to get an overview of the problem and begin to get an idea of what we're going to have to do in order to respond to it intelligently.
Really? And you just got a real short time to say, you know, why isn't everybody up in arms? I mean, since Cheney's even talking about it, Halliburton knows about it. And obviously, the same people that are head of oil companies are also, you know, in the cabinet. So how come they're not doing something?
Yeah. Well, this is the most important piece of information anybody could have at this time of history. But our politicians are not going to say a word about it because it's not going to win them any votes. And industry, the bankers, no one is going to say anything about it because it doesn't lead to economic growth. It's exactly the opposite. It's bad news for the stock market. But we need to know because we need to be prepared because our lives are going to be on the line as a result of this.
Mm-hmm. I would think that it would be a good thing to be making solar panels, and I think that they would make money, that there would be a niche where money could be made.
Well, that's why the oil companies have bought up most of the solar industry in the last few years. But maybe in our next program, we can talk more about the energy alternatives. I'm sure there are many listeners right now who are sitting there going, well, why aren't they talking about wind or solar and all of the solutions? Well, we need to talk about that. So that would be a good subject for our next show.
Yeah, we will. But in the remaining minutes, just a little information about why not more is done.
Yeah. Well, we desperately need to be investing far more in renewable alternatives, particularly solar and wind, because those are ones that can be grown. We get a lot more energy right now from hydropower, which is renewable energy, but we can't dam many more rivers. And in fact, most of the ecologists I know would rather see the existing dams taken out rather than more of them being built. But we can build a lot more wind turbines and photovoltaic panels. So we definitely need to be doing that, but it's a larger discussion, and I want to talk about that.
Right. And we will talk about it, and that's also the name of your book, Richard Heinberg, is Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. And the whole power down is that we just can't continue living how we've lived, oil or not, and we just can't continue this way, but we can certainly make it easier on ourselves rather than hard on ourselves. So tune in for the next show, and thanks so much, Richard Heinberg.
Thank you, Sue.
Did you want to give a website or anything?
Yeah, my website is www.musele.com, and I have a number of essays posted there, and also people can contact me or get my books through the website.
Thank you very much for your time, for writing this book, and we'll talk again soon. My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. If you're interested in hearing other of my programs and looking at my website, go to www.suesupriano.com. Sue Supriano is SueSupriano. And to order copies of my shows or just communicate with me, you can send me an email at sue@suesupriano.com. So the website is suesupriano.com, and the email is sue@suesupriano.com. Thanks for listening.